morning, we're bringing you our monthly ethics focus program, Difficult Decisions in Healthcare. What would you do? And this morning's topic will really get your brain going and your juices flowing. It's the topic of organ donation. And as I'm sure you're aware, there aren't nearly enough organs for transplant, and that creates two major problems. How do we decide who should receive the ones available? How do we increase the supply? Dr. Gregory Eastwood from Upstate Center for Bioethics and Humanities is here to help us guide the conversation. Good morning, Dr. Eastwood.
Good morning, Tricia. Good to be back.
And shortly, Dr. Amy Freeman will join us. Dr. Eastwood will be introducing her at the time, but she is the professor of surgery and the director of organ transplantation at Upstate. She's going to join us to answer some of our questions and help us understand some of the complicated aspects to this ethical conundrum. So, organ transplantation capabilities have really been around for a while, haven't they, Dr. Eastwood?
Well, they've been around for a while. I think we can trace the origins back to maybe the 30s when Dr. Willem Kolff in the Netherlands started to tinker with the idea of dialysis and then developed what was first the first dialysis machine.
My gosh, that's 75 years ago.
That's right. His story is interesting, and I don't want to spend too much time on it, but he did a lot of his research during the Nazi occupation in the early 1940s. And that, of course, led to the realistic ability to do transplantations, first with kidneys, of course,
right,
in the early 1950s, and then with multiple other organs, which Dr. Friedman a little later will explain to us.
It is an amazing kind of thing. Now, recently, too, we've read in the news about a face transplant. What do we know about that?
I frankly don't know a lot about that,
okay,
except that it's very fascinating and very complicated. I think something that we'll want to learn more about.
Absolutely.
Later.
And then I understand, too, there was a trachea transplant in Spain not too long ago, I think maybe at the end of last year.
Yes, and we'll talk about that because that's an interesting extension of the current technology.
It absolutely is. Transplants have been taking place for all of these years, and they keep improving. I know that one of the big shifts has been, we hear about, or one of the conversations we'll have, are transplants that take place between live donors, somebody donating part of their body to someone they care about, perhaps, mm-hmm, or at least that they match. And then some of the transplants do come from people who have recently died. And that's really a part of what we have to discuss, isn't it?
That is. And, of course, the key thing here is the match, the immune match. If you take a transplanted organ from someone who's died, there is less chance that that will be a good match. And I think we need to explore how that works. And of course, from a living donor, that person can be a relative or not. Mm-hmm. If they're a relative, there's a better chance that that person will be a good match.
Right, because their blood will match and other parts of their immune system will match. I read somewhere that there are about 100,000 people on any given day in this country who are awaiting a transplant. That's a staggering number.
It is a staggering number, and we reached that threshold within the last few months, and we can expect it only to increase. 100,000 people, a lot of people. And I think we can expect the number of people who are awaiting an organ for transplantation to increase for a number of reasons. One of those is that we're probably going to expand the payment for such, and we're going to perhaps allow people that weren't allowed before to have maybe foreigners, more foreigners to be eligible.
You know, it raises a whole lot of issues. And of course, the big issue is deciding who's going to get a transplant. So Dr. Eastwood, you have a way to pose this question so we can really understand it, an exercise you use with medical students?
Yes, Tricia. I've had the privilege of interacting with medical students for several years, and I find the experience exciting and invigorating. This is an exercise that forces the students to think about a number of issues associated with transplantation. It's not something that we actually apply to the selection of organs. I want to make that absolutely clear. But let me go through the exercise. The students are asked to select one out of seven possible candidates for a heart transplantation. And their selections are based on a number of things. You'll see as I read these various candidates. First is a 63-year-old man with coronary artery disease. He's a millionaire, and he's devoted much of his life to public service. He's served on a governor's commission. He's donated $1 million for Alzheimer's disease research. He's married in a stable marriage. The second is a 45-year-old man with a severe cardiomyopathy secondary to alcohol abuse. He's been abstinent from alcohol for 6 months. He's divorced. He's a vet of the Gulf War, and he's expressed the sentiment that the government owes him something. The third is a 27-year-old woman who is currently a law student, or she's on leave of absence from law school. She has what's called a viral cardiomyopathy. She had a breakup with her fiancé recently, and that led to an attempted overdose with sleeping pills, but she volunteers at a battered woman's shelter, and she has a close family. The next is a 38-year-old woman who is a mother of three children. She has valvular heart disease and what's called systemic lupus with multiple complications. And she and her partner, Grace, have been longtime members of the church, and the church is very supportive. The next is a 47-year-old man with coronary artery disease who has had a previous coronary artery bypass. He happens to be a prisoner right now, and he's eligible for parole in 5 years, and his brother has offered to give him a place to stay after he's released in 5 years. The sixth is a 55-year-old woman who received a heart transplant 4 years ago. She now needs another one because of rejection, and she is on leave of absence from her job as a newscaster. She has a stable marriage, three grown children, has a PhD from Maxwell School of Citizenship at SU. And the final person is a 15-year-old girl with congenital heart disease and Down syndrome. She's the only child of very loving parents. She attends school, loves swimming, but the question is whether she understands the meaning and consequences of transplant surgery. So there are a number of social and other issues associated with these applicants. And as I say, the selection of applicants, which will be dealt with a lot more with our guest, Dr. Amy Friedman, is not purely on the basis of social considerations. But again, when you think through the ethical issues associated with this, young, old, ability to understand, ability to take medications after the surgery, and so on, these are all very important considerations.
Absolutely, and they do give us a real sense of how difficult it is to make these decisions. So, listeners, I'll pose this to you. Who do you think deserves the first available heart? You may have some ideas or questions. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about what goes into making these decisions and still others. So please stay with us. This is SUNY Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air on 570 WSYR. Well, welcome back to HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by SUNY Upstate Medical University, making the academic difference in healthcare in the Central New York community. And this is Tricia Torrey, Every Patient's Advocate. We're continuing our conversation about organ donation with Dr. Gregory Eastwood from Upstate's Center for Bioethics and Humanities. And Dr. Eastwood, will you introduce our special guest this morning?
Yeah, I'd be pleased to. We have Dr. Amy Friedman here. She's professor of surgery and director of the organ transplantation service at University Hospital, which, of course, we all know is part of SUNY Upstate Medical University.
Of course. You know, Dr. Friedman, this is your life, isn't it? You're dealing with donors and recipients and procedures all the time.
Absolutely, and thanks. It's great to be here, Greg and Tricia. In fact, more than you know, I have three organ transplant recipients within my own family.
In your family?
Yeah.
Is that what compelled you to get involved in this?
It probably is. My mother became developed kidney failure when I was in medical school.
Oh my gosh. Tell us, what's the procedure? What happens?
When we have somebody who is in need of an organ, a kidney, a heart, or a liver, they need to be evaluated at a UNOS, United Network for Organ Sharing, approved organ transplant center, where the center and their team will consider that person as an individual, their health and their psychosocial background. Is this a person who can benefit from having an organ transplant? Are they likely to live long enough to be able to benefit and well use that very precious resource? And are they likely to take care of it? If so, they will be placed on the UNOS active waiting list and then have to wait their turn within the system for an organ.
So they pretty much fit the description in many cases, not those specific descriptions that Dr. Eastwood gave us before we took the break, but descriptions that are similar.
That's quite true. In fact, the vast majority of people with these types of organ failure do qualify for organ transplants, which is our dilemma.
Wow. Wow. If somebody becomes a donor and maybe they've had a car accident, maybe they have died of something else and they have said they wanted to be an organ donor before, do you automatically look at the list of who's available, or is that done in a different way?
So there's a network across the country of organ procurement organizations, or the so-called organ banks, and our local one is the Finger Lakes Donor Recovery Network.
Right, and they've been here and talked to us.
That's right, and I work with them. In fact, I'm one of the medical directors. But the hospital is required by law to let the organ procurement organization know of the death of an appropriate patient or a potential impending death. And then the coordinators from the organ procurement organization will evaluate the specific information for that person who has died and consider whether they might be a suitable organ donor, and if so, move forward with the process.
And an organ donor is somebody who's going to donate many, many parts of their body.
Well, we really would like that to be the case. We are trying very hard when a person does die in suitable circumstances to use as many organs as possible from each person because, for example, if we can save 7 lives from one death, it's pretty remarkable. I'll also point out that they can, of course, be tissue donors as well.
Sure, sure they can. But what we know more than anything else is that there are way too many patients and not nearly enough organs, and that actually sets the stage for our ethics discussion. Dr. Eastwood, go ahead and get us started with some of the questions we need to be asking about organ donation.
Well, I think one question that many people have is, if I'm an organ donor, are the doctors going to be keeping me alive a little bit longer than I should be? Or are they going to be doing other things that maybe are not in my own best interest? And Dr. Friedman, maybe you could answer that.
Oh, I would be very happy to. First, we can't keep people who have died alive. We can support their heart, for example, but if their brain has died, they are legally dead. If the family consents, we may continue to support the function of the heart and lungs for a brief enough period to allow us to evaluate the organs and work through the computer system to find and identify appropriate recipients and then get organ donation teams into the setting. But the answer is no. We primarily, across this country, absolutely care for a person fully in their interests until they have died. If they have died, if we are able to continue to support their body while the brain is dead, we will do so with consent. I have enough faith in the integrity of the system in this country that I personally carry an organ donor card, and so do my 3 children and my husband.
And so do I.
And I do too.
Well, there you go. You know, knowing that there are so few organs, and knowing that you have this UNOS, the system that determines who is going to get, let's say, who's going to be at the top of the list, one of the things that is kind of, I guess it's an ethical question, is if it's the very sickest people who end up at the top of the list, aren't they the people whose organs are most likely to fail?
Boy, this is the real essence of our dilemma. First, let me clarify that each organ type is allocated within a specific set of rules. So, for example, for a heart transplant, how sick the potential recipient is plays a major role because the sickest person does most urgently need the heart.
Sure.
On the other hand, in truth, they are sickest and least likely to survive the transplant operation. And that's tough and a dilemma. On the other hand, with kidneys, because we do have dialysis available for immediate support, the severity of illness does not play a role, and it's a combination of how close the match is and how long the individual has been waiting.
Okay, so that is weighed by this computer that determines.
Absolutely, and the UNOS system is designed to have multidisciplinary input into the creation of these allocation
rules. It does. Good, good. Dr. Eastwood?
Well, I think, this raises some other issues, too, and they're implied in the scenarios that I gave at the very beginning of the show.
Yes.
And even though I was careful to point out that this is an exercise we use for medical students to think through about their own thoughts.
Right, none of those people are real people.
They're not real people.
Right.
On the other hand, it does raise the question of what role does age play? What role does mental ability? What role does the ability to understand the implications of such surgery and what is implied in terms of taking medications for many years afterwards? What role does so-called social worth? You know, we had a millionaire there who gave a lot of money to research and so on.
And what about like illegal aliens or even convicts? Didn't I just read that Marion Barry, who was the former mayor of Washington, who was arrested for all kinds of illegal drug activity, he just received an organ?
Well, I have no insider information, but what I've read from the popular media is that he had a live donor kidney transplant from a friend who voluntarily gave him a kidney. Mm. So in that circumstance, we celebrate such transplants because a live donor kidney is the best quality kidney, without question, gives him the best chance of living as long as possible. But just as for a deceased donor kidney, that transplant center certainly had to evaluate the recipient as an individual and determine whether he was capable of taking care of that kidney.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, it raises other questions. What about people who are, say, contagious with some kind of a disease, someone with HIV or AIDS?
So here, too, we have lots of problems. With the recipients, we want to make sure that whatever infectious disease they may have is not likely to limit their life. For example, we used to exclude HIV-positive people because we thought they would have horrible infections from the rejection medications. Over the years, we've learned, in fact, that people who have stable HIV disease and take their medications do very well, and so now they, too, are qualified to have a transplant, which is the key issue. More and more people are suitable, and therefore the shortage becomes more severe.
So with some of those points in mind, let's go back now and look at those people that Dr. Eastwood introduced us to and talk about the kinds of things that might or might not affect their selection to receive a heart.
Okay.
Well, Dr. Friedman, one of the patients or donor applicants that I told you about was a 47-year-old man who was in prison. How do we regard prisoner status?
So The problem for prisoners is that, of course, emotionally, we don't want to give them organs. We don't want to take care of things. But if they're in prison for any lesser crime than something that leads to the death sentence, that crime becomes a death sentence when they need an organ transplant. They do have health insurance, which is great. What about the 45 million people in the country who don't have health insurance?
Good question.
Does the prisoner get the transplant in lieu of the uninsured, legitimate, legally minded person? And when the prisoner is let out of prison, does he have health insurance then? Will he take his medications afterwards?
Wow.
Lots of issues, but the bottom line today is prisoners are allowed to have organ transplants.
Another case that I explained was this 15-year-old girl with Down syndrome. She has what we would regard as mental retardation, but otherwise is a very lovely young lady and is loved very much by her family. How would
and
you
seems
regard
to have
that?
A good quality of life except for her heart.
Right. So here we have somebody who is unlikely to become independent as an adult and take good care of herself and take her medications and understand things. But as long as she has a psychosocial support system that we anticipate will be there for perpetuity, then she may, in fact, take her medications more reliably than others who don't have a support system to ensure that she does. This case, similarly, has been tried in the courts, and one does not have the legal right to decline organ transplants simply because of Down syndrome or other mental disabilities.
Wow, we have time for one more.
Well, then there's this woman that is a law student, a young woman at, let's say, SU Law School. She has a viral cardiomyopathy. She does have a history of a sleeping pill overdose, but she has a social conscience. She works in a women's shelter. What about her?
So we have a person who seems to be a productive member of society who tried to kill herself. Is she likely to do that again, and therefore are we wasting an organ?
Mm.
So we need a psychosocial evaluation here that says no, she probably had a reactive gesture that is not likely to recur. So in this case, if the psychiatrist supports it, she would be eligible.
Wow. Well, listeners, You've heard some of the questions, and who do you think deserves that first available heart? When we come back, we're going to talk about more ideas about making these decisions and others, increasing the supply, for instance. But this is SUNY Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on air on 570 WSYR.